Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to this FreeCP 112. Very happy to have you here with me today. And I'm starting this week with a little clarification. A question I've often heard is, what is the difference between a charter city and a free city? And as always, it's a little bit nuanced, but basically, well, according to me at least, they are a bit like Coke and Pepsi. The Free Cities moniker originated from free private cities, which is of course Titus Gebel's model for private governance. That is now under the umbrella term of free cities, and it incorporates a spectrum of different governance models, including charter cities, as long as they are promoting the rights and freedoms of individuals. Charter cities, on the other hand, are cities granted special jurisdiction to create a new governance system, in particular with regards to deep regulatory and administrative reforms. Sound familiar? Of course. The ZAs of Honduras are probably the best example these days, but you could class them as both a free city or a charter city. Depends which brand of Coke you drink, I suppose. Anyway, I hope that somewhat sorts it out. Today's guests, the reason I've mentioned this, both work at the Charter Cities Institute, and that's the non-profit building the ecosystem for charter cities. Mark Lutter is the founder and executive director of the Institute, and Carl Peterson is the senior manager for special projects. Now, this week I'm going to go straight to my trusty AI servant to sum up this episode, mainly because, do you know what? He slash she slash it is getting pretty good at this point. Okay, in this episode we explore the evolving landscape of charter cities in Africa, focusing on ambitious projects in Zanzibar and the broader implications for urban development across the continent. Mark and Carl share insights into the NXT 50 Cities Coalition, which is an initiative aimed at fostering new urban centres with potentially innovative governance models. They discuss the challenges and opportunities of building new cities from scratch, emphasising the importance of special economic zones and decentralized authority to drive growth. The conversation delves into the complexities of partnering with governments, navigating bureaucracy, and the role of local engagement in ensuring the success of these projects. Mark and Carl provide a candid analysis of the lessons learned from projects like Prospera and Ciudad Morazan, offering a nuanced perspective on the potential of charter cities to contribute to economic development and governance innovation. Not bad, really. I'm happy with that. My take, in addition, this is the view from the people on the ground trying to actually build free cities, or charter cities, as they would call them. And you know that we're on that side of the fence too, so this kind of conversation will always offer invaluable insights to the listener. Many thanks to Mark and Carl for coming in to see us. Back to the Nosta boosts and comments for the first time this year. And many thanks to the Fountain app for making it so easy to see all these in one place. I'm going to do a super quick roundup. Thank you to all of you for the sats, which have gone straight into the FreeCP SBR. Do you like that acronym? That's the Free Cities Podcast Strategic Bitcoin Reserve, of course. It's an SBR now already. Things are moving on. Come on, keep up. Anyway, thanks to Justin Bianchi, Cousin Vinny, Aaron, User 229, Crypto Connect, and AJ Gernerin. I think I've pronounced that right. Thanks for this episode, going through a fork in the road in my own life. Might have to take some shrooms and think about it. That's from Justin, thank you. And he's obviously referring to last week's show with Alex Martinov, episode 111, where I recounted a pivotal experience in my life, which happened because I basically took magic mushrooms. Go and give that a listen if you will. In fact, that episode, as I mentioned in the intro, was a really pivotal point in my life also, and it really has, and I can't speak to that too much now. All I can say is that this podcast is expanding and moving very quickly on account of what we spoke about in that episode. So go and give it a listen if you too are at a fork in your own life. Lots of Merry Christmases and lots of Happy New Years. I haven't done Nosta comments since just before Christmas. Great conversation. Thank you both. That's about Per Bylund's episode 104. What's going on in Honduras? Answer, socialism. Thank you, Papa Figo. That's about talking about Alex Ugorji's episode 109. That's Alex's view from Ciudad Morazan, the ZA, which is currently under pressure from the government. I'm going to keep it brief this week because, yeah, I know. I know you're rearing to hear the conversation, so I will round it up here, pointing you to the show notes where all the links that you could ever require are. And, of course, I will finish in the time-honoured tradition. And this one goes out to you, especially if you're currently sitting in a self-driving Tesla. Just sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Mark Lutter and Carl Peterson. I think maybe the best thing might be to just introduce yourselves first. I mean, I know who you are, but let's hear it straight from yourselves. Mark, do you want to go first?
Sure. I'm Mark Lutter. I'm the founder and executive director of the Charter Cities Institute, a nonprofit building the ecosystem for charter cities.
And I'm Carl Peterson. I'm the senior manager for special projects at the Charter Cities Institute. I work for Mark.
All right, so be careful then.
I've had to be careful for 4.5 years now.
Is that right? Yeah. Do you like working at the Charter Cities Institute?
I like it very much.
Good. something that obviously is connecting you both here today, which in your talks at Liberty in Our Lifetime, was the continent of Africa. You were talking about a project in Zanzibar, and as far as I understand it, you were talking about, because unfortunately I couldn't go, I was doing this, I'm doing this all day, every day, but you were talking about Africa in general and something called, which I'd never heard of, which was called NXT50, is that right?
Yeah, just our stylized version of like Next 50, so it's Africa's Next 50 Cities Coalition.
Who started that?
So it's been a CCI initiative for a number of years. The branding idea actually was started by John Vandenhoevel. Who leads a project called Small Farm Cities that's based in Malawi.
And what I was interested to know was how much of these kind of projects, how much kind of overlap is there with the kind of charter city version of this? Because quite a lot of the time, I would imagine, I don't know, but these kind of projects don't really consider the kind of things that we tend to consider. They're more thinking about just cities in the traditional sense. Is that right?
Yeah. So for us, the Next 50 Cities Coalition is sort of focused on this CCI charter city development model, where you have, you know, larger projects, so physically large in terms of land area, looking at 10 square kilometers or more, looking at large population targets ultimately, so like 100,000 people or more. Obviously, all of this built in a phased approach. But importantly, you're looking at the special jurisdiction aspect of a sort of special economic zone model or charter city model, where you're decentralizing or devolving more authority to the city government, right? That's the goal. That's the idea of what we're sort of promoting and advocating for in terms of the Next 50 Cities Coalition. But there, if you look at the population trends with population growth and rapid urbanization, new cities are already being built in Africa, like literally hundreds are being built now. And so the issue there is like, these are already being built. why don't we build some that have more of a charter city model?
And before we go to Mark, when you say brand new cities, do you literally mean a bit of brownfield or whatever, and someone comes in and just builds it from scratch? We're not talking about building upon what's already there.
Yeah, so a couple of different ways, right? So it is, some of it is basically, you know, suburbs or expansions of existing cities, and some of it is almost sort of a Chinese style, like brand new city being built. So it's a little bit of both.
So, and is Zanzibar under the umbrella, your Zanzibar project, does it come under this umbrella, or is this something?
Yeah, so I actually don't know.
It does.
Yeah, okay, yeah. Great. Yes, it is under the umbrella. So the Zanzibar project has several different dimensions. So one dimension is we're partnering with CPS, which is the developer of Fumba Town. Fumba Town is a small town outside of Zanzibar City, about 20 minutes south of the airport. And they have 60 hectares of land. They've developed about half of it, have, I don't know, 600-700 units complete, with another 600-700 under development. And so we're working with them, as well as figuring out how to work effectively with the government to develop a model for more effective zone development. So there's a special economic zone in Zanzibar that was set up over 30 years ago. The special economic zone is 3,000 hectares, so 7,500 acres, just south of Zanzibar City on a peninsula. A very good location. Zanzibar City is doubling in size every 20 years or so, so we'll have another 800,000 new urban residents. And because Stone Town, kind of the core of Zanzibar City, is a UNESCO heritage site, you can't build up, so the city tends to build out instead. And there the idea is, okay, the special economic zone exists, but the government, like many governments in emerging markets, doesn't really have the capacity to develop it to its full extent. So our proposition to the government was, look, let's partner with you. Let's figure out how to bring in capital for important infrastructure, roads, water, electricity, etc. And we can also work with you to figure out how to promote the investment opportunities in this peninsula more effectively. We worked with the Zanzibar Investment Promotion Agency, which manages the zone, to help them develop a strategic plan for the priorities they have over the next 5 years. And then in addition to this kind of the, let's call it, charter city aspect of the zone, we're also doing two other things. One is we're working with the African School of Economics, which is a university. They have four campuses in West Africa, in Benin, Cote d'Ivoire, and two in Nigeria. So we're working with them to open their first campus in East Africa, starting with the African Urban Lab, which is a research center that's a joint project with the Charter Cities Institute and the African School of Economics. The first set of courses there start this week, next week. This is the first week of November. The first set of courses is a professional program, and then looking to roll out a master's program next year. And then the other thing we're doing in Zanzibar, we hosted an event called Zanzalu last year. Some of your listeners might have heard of Zuzalu, which was Vitalik Buterin's kind of pop-up city in Montenegro about a year and a half ago. Can you bring a few hundred people to one place for 2 months? And then what are the social dynamics? So Zanzalu last year, I guess this year, earlier this summer, was 5 weeks. We had about 800 people total in and out. Good representation across East Africa, a handful of Europeans. One of the focuses we wanted to use Zanzalu for was, kind of making sure that it wasn't this just a bunch of foreigners coming in. So we focused pretty hard on local engagement. For example, we hosted a student weekend where we had the State University of Zanzibar come and attend talks. We had a kind of startup weekend where we had entrepreneurs from Dar es Salaam, the city in Tanzania that's about a 30-minute flight from Zanzibar, give presentations. And so the kind of long-term kind of thing is, all right, like, yes, you need the legal regulatory aspect, but you also need, like, that's not sufficient. How do you also get the other pieces in place in terms of education, in terms of talent attraction, in terms of physical infrastructure? And we see this as kind of a long-term project, working with the Zanzibari government to figure out how to put these building blocks in place.
I've got so many questions. very briefly, quickly, the 3,000 hectare spot in Zanzibar, was it a port or is it a port? Is that why it's a special economic zone? Or?
No, they have three or four special economic zones. The primary port in Zanzibar is in Stone Town. They're looking at building a new port north. They've done early feasibility studies. I don't have a clear sense of the timeline. There actually is a small port in the special economic zone that's privately run. But it's quite small, Carl.
Yeah.
No more information.
No, I don't know a bunch more, but
no one lives there yet, though.
So in the zone, there's Fumba Town, which is that is in the zone. There's a handful of other. There, for example, is also what's called Fumba Uptown, which is another kind of high-end residential development that was built by one of Tanzania's kind of wealthiest businessmen. Fumba Town has, depending on the time of year, 400 to 600 people living there. Fumba Uptown was less successful. They've completed a lot of structures, but it doesn't really have a resident. So it's a little bit of a ghost town. It might also be on about 60 hectares. You have like one or two other kind of high-end residential projects. You also are starting to see kind of urban growth. So you're seeing informal settlements that are basically part of the urban growth of Zanzibar City start to spill into the north end of the zone. So the total population of the zone is probably, 10,000.
And do those people reap the benefits of the kind of special economic aspects of that zone?
Right now, no. The informal settlements, the zone, right? The zone has the legal authority to set up a one-stop shop, and they've had that authority for at least a decade. I don't think they've set that one-stop shop up yet. This was kind of where we see the opportunity as a government that really wants to do it. But just because, like many governments, has limited resources, figuring out how the private sector can partner with them to take this kind of foundation that's already solid and kind of administer it, attract investment, really take it to the next level.
We were speaking last night, and you mentioned it's a pretty long-winded procedure. People are often very excited at the beginning, and then you kind of hit a wall of bureaucracy. Is that your experiences around there?
Certainly, it's my experience, I think, broadly with lots of projects. You know, if you're talking both real estate projects and then working with governments, right? I make a joke a lot, but you know, if you're working with the government, things move at the speed of government, which is usually not very fast. So I think that is my personal experience is between being a real estate project and working with governments, a lot of this stuff is longer timelines than I would like personally. But I also think to some degree, it's kind of like baked into the problem set.
And why is that though? Why is it that governments move so slowly when they supposedly have the best interest of the places at their heart?
Yeah, I think a lot of it, you know, you get like maybe a very sort of doctrinaire libertarian answer of like it's the incentive structure isn't there for governments to move at a quicker pace or a more efficient pace, right? So you have some governments around the world that like maybe the government employees are paid to some degree on performance, right? Like in Singapore, there's some degree of pay for performance and attracting high quality talent. But for the most part, most places in the world, you know, there's this implicit understanding that government work is like you maybe don't work as hard, the money isn't as good, but like it's job security kind of thing. I think that's the place around like most places in the world.
What about, I mean, we've been going to Dubai quite a lot recently. You do see, it appears at least, you see maybe not in the government itself, but you certainly see a lot of things advancing there very, very quickly. What do you think? Do you know much about Dubai? Do you know what the difference might be there?
Yeah, I mean, I think part of it is there's a, like, one reason governments might not be as responsive is because, right, they don't go out of business if they're a little bit slower. Dubai, for example, right, its success is largely predicated on the fact that it was kind of the liberal place to do business in a region experiencing a massive resource boom. So if you're a multinational and you were looking in the 70s to open an office in the Middle East and say, look, there's a lot of oil being produced here. We want a presence. We want to sell our goods. et cetera, right? You look at Iran, oh, they just had a revolution, and right, like now it's a theocracy, we don't want to go there. Oh, Lebanon has a civil war. Oh, Saudi Arabia, right, like women can't show their face. You end up in Dubai. And so I think because of that, Dubai has, for at least its modern history, has had relatively strong competitive pressure, forcing it to, I guess, up its game in terms of attracting investment, in terms of retaining capital, talent, etc. And so, right, a government is not a monolith. It depends on the historic circumstances of the people, of the kind of capital structure, of the trading networks. And I think in thinking about how, one, charter cities fit in, it's important not to just have a theoretical framework and say, yes, this is how everything should be. It's like, sure, but like, what does that mean in practice? It's important to say, okay, look, based on, right, like the history, based on the existing income levels, based on urbanization rates, right, here is what can be done in 5 years, in 10 years, in 20 years, and have expectations in line with kind of what can be accomplished. And so, yeah, I think, right, Singapore also, for example, is a government that is very effective, and they have kind of unique historic conditions that led to that level of effectiveness. And the question is, like, I think for us generally in this space, like, can we identify similar starting conditions today where if we give them the right nudge, if we figure out how to pass the right law, get the right partners to the table, etc., can we start something that in 50, 60 years might not look like full Singapore, but look, half Singapore is pretty good, a third Singapore is pretty good, depending on what the starting conditions are, that could create a lot of wealth, raise a lot of people out of poverty, lead to some outcomes that are much better than the status quo.
So in the case of Zanzibar then, or Africa in general, what is that factor that you're looking for? Like, you know, Singapore, you just mentioned Singapore, Dubai, why it is that these are the kind of places that are ripe for this kind of, you know, evolution. What is it in Africa that you're looking for?
Sure. So I guess Zanzibar is a historic trading hub. And so they have that kind of internal culture of trading, of commerce, et cetera, baked in. They're also getting East Africa, Zanzibar as well, is kind of getting the benefits from Indian commerce, from Arab investment. The Indian Institute of Technology, for example, which is one of the, I think, top 100 education institutions in the world, opened a campus in Zanzibar. It's their first overseas campus. And so we see these as very important kind of underlying factors. Africa in generally will have almost 1 billion new urban residents over the next 30 years. And so I think one of the challenges of building cities is, where do the residents come from, right? If you're trying to build a frontier cutting edge city, that means on some margin you're competing with New York, you're competing with San Francisco, you're competing with London for residents. Those are already very successful developed cities, right? And so how do you get the first 1,000, the first 10,000 residents when the people living in those cities are already very happy with where they live? When you have a rapidly urbanizing population, right, the demand is baked in for new urban settlements. And there, the question is, right, how do you create a governance structure, physical infrastructure that is appropriate to the price point at which these new urban residents are urbanizing, that they can kind of start creating value, start working their way up the supply chain, where hopefully you can build the conditions that can lead to one, maybe 2 percentage point higher growth over several decades, which compounds and has a really large impact in terms of their living standards.
I think it's probably true to say as well that people will want, it's not a case of, do I live in a new city in Africa or New York? It's like, I'm from here, I want to live here. Or, as we've seen recently, I think El Salvador is a good example. People moving back to El Salvador because They want to be there because they were abroad for another reason. They were abroad for an economic reason or for a safety reason or whatever. And now they don't need to be. They really do want to come home and do that thing. I'm sure that that must be a large part of, you know, the way to get bootstrap a city in Africa, especially in someone in a special economic zone. What we'll need to ask you both is, and this is something I've only cottoned onto recently, was the idea that charter cities, free cities, were a kind of natural extension of the special economic zone. I take it you've probably known that for a while, have you? Or do maybe you don't even know that. You do, I take it. Is that, you believe that? Yeah. So is that now the focus? You know, is that what you would be, the way you think? It's like, okay, let's find either, let's establish an SEZ and then work on that, or let's find some SEZs and then go in and negotiate at that level.
Yeah, so I mean, it's certainly from my perspective, right, when I started at CCI, that seemed to be maybe part of CCI's thesis at the time, I think it still broadly is that you are taking this model for special economic zones, SEZs, that already existed, and you're either changing it to use it for your purposes for a city, or you are latching onto pre-existing SEZs and adjusting them for your purposes as well, right? My sort of perspective on this, I can't speak for Mark, but my sort of feeling is if you're looking at maybe you know, the special jurisdiction space or free city space more broadly, you probably have a few different models you can look at, right? And the charter cities or CCI model is one that is focused on economic growth and rapid urbanization, right? So I think it, in the a broader sense, it's not like an answer for all of the, you know, quote unquote free cities movement, but I think that it is a partial answer, right? I think it's also a substantial answer for these issues of economic growth you have in the developing world.
Yeah, I think to add on that, if you look at China, Shenzhen, people call it a special economic zone, but if you look at the underlying kind of structure, it's closer to a charter city. In terms of land area, it was 320 square kilometers, so much larger than an industrial park that might kind of define many special economic zones. If you look at the delegated authority that Shenzhen had, it was everything except for like rail, post office, national defense, maybe monetary policy, but they had delegated authority on a very wide range of civil law and commercial law. And so I think that's important. Many special economic zones don't work, right? They might just have only tax breaks, or they might have poor administration, or they might be located in a region that isn't economically competitive. And so there's definitely a lot to build on from the economic zone model. I would say the way that charter cities do kind of differ is the sense that on some margin, right, like charter cities are going to be political units to the extent that special economic zones aren't. And so obviously we've seen this with Hong Kong and China over the last decade, where China felt threatened by Hong Kong's free speech norms and laws, which in part prompted the aggressive Chinese crackdown. We are seeing in Honduras the aggressive crackdown on Prospera and Ciudad Mortazan from the central government. Though Honduras, they're also cracking down on the special economic zones. So I think it's and so, right, like it's important for charter cities to be integrated into a country in terms of the political system, in terms of the supply chain, in terms of labor markets, capital markets. But at the same time, just given the, I guess, scope of ambition of charter cities, there's always going to be a element that makes that dance a little bit more challenging than a standard special economic zone would be.
Let's talk about that then, because it's big news at the moment. And I spend a lot of time discussing with people the best ways to secure an autonomous region or a charter city or whatever. And, you know, until recently, I would have said the best method is the legal framework that holds it in place. But as we can see in Honduras now, The government, even at that level, can just come in and say, well, do you know what? None of that makes any sense. It's not real. So have you got a kind of 101 on the way you approach these things? Like, how do you secure your city or your place in place? What are the best methods you have to make sure that it survives and it lasts and it thrives and it doesn't get bullied out of existence, as we're seeing, or any other ways? What are your techniques?
So there's no silver bullet, but I think we can, I guess, maybe run through the brief history of Honduras just for a recap. All right, the Honduras legislation was passed after a constitutional crisis, a coup, where the sitting head of state was forced out of power by the military. He was also trying to run for a second term, which was unconstitutional, and his own party turned against him. But, right, like any time you have a forcible change in government like that, there is a question about legitimacy for the next government. And then when the next government passed the legislation that empowered the charter cities, there was never a large popular support for that legislation, right? It was a handful of key people in that political party. And so I think part of the challenge in Honduras has been that there's, I think, a, on some margin, legitimate question for the foundation of the law. Two, I think Honduras is hard, Latin America is hard, because the left-wing parties are sometimes literally communist, right? Other countries where the elections might be like populist and slightly different flavor of populist, it's a bit easier to create a long-term stable system than when a party is just literally communist and wants to expropriate anything that resembles private capital. I think a third element is the narrative, and this has been a challenge in Honduras, because given for the last decade, even before Prospera, this was branded as like your libertarian colonialism, etc. And if you're able to, right from the beginning, not have that brand, form effective partnerships with local institutions, you might be able to evade some of that popular kind of pushback. So I think the yes, you want to do the kind of legal guarantees, but perhaps more important than the legal guarantees are what might be described as the political structuring of the project. And in practice, what this means is, I think, one, you want kind of wealthy families, industrial groups, the political elites in the country to invest in the project, because they will be able to influence the government. And if they have a vested financial interest, right, they will use that to push the kind of government in a positive direction. You probably also want to ensure, right, like large job creation, large trade within the country. That might mean picking industries where there's already a strong base. For example, Ciudad Morazan had an industrial park up and running until the new government came into power. And so if you're able to create those jobs, create that supply chain network, right, people who might be ideologically opposed start to see the benefits of it. And hey, maybe this isn't so scary, like my sister has a job there, or like I go there every other week because we have to buy X. Other ways you can do it, for example, you can structure the capital. So if you use a development finance institution, for example, for part of the infrastructure for the development, many countries in emerging markets might have like 2, 3, 4 loans from a development finance institution. So that might make them a lot more reluctant to take strong aggressive action against the charter city, because that could threaten the lending streams for other infrastructure projects. And so by tying it up in kind of existing capital structures, that limits the ability of the country to take kind of strong aggressive action. I think, I guess, maybe to summarize kind of the high level framing we use is, these should not be viewed as like exit, a way to escape the country. They should be viewed as empowerment tools within the country, in terms of capital flows, in terms of job creation, in terms of target industries, in terms of government priorities. And if you do that, and are able to get buy-in from the different levels of society, it's not a silver bullet, but it does make it a little bit more challenging for the government to take aggressive action against it, because it's kind of embedded within the different stakeholder groups that tend to determine what how the government acts.
Yeah, I mean, I broadly just agree with Mark. I'm a lawyer. Background is I'm a lawyer. So I'm familiar with a lot of the legal issues here to some degree or another. Obviously I can't give any legal advice, especially, you know, not on a podcast, but, you know, my intuition as a lawyer is to, like, I want to avoid resorting to the legal system, right? If you can keep your problems from getting to other lawyers, right? That's broadly best, right? So you want broad-based popular support from different layers of society, like Mark said, before you start resorting to relying on legal protections of some kind or another. And I have a lot of praise for Prospera and Ciudad Morazan for their structuring of their investor protection agreements and things like that. So after they started suffering from maybe some sort of legal chicanery at a higher level with the government, you know, they were able to fall back on these investor protection agreements. And now, like, you know, I think they're in a fairly good position to win in arbitration. I can't totally predict what the outcome will be, but I think it's more likely than not that they'll be able to at least recoup their investment. They don't want that. They want to, you know, operate their projects, which would be ideal for them. But, you know, the key issue there is, like, sure, like, you'll win in arbitration, but, like, you can't run your project anymore. Now, like, you have a bad name for this type of project, you know, maybe globally. It doesn't look great necessarily to, like, have, you know, a private project fighting a government. A lot of people have that, you know, they see that and they feel a certain way about that. So from my perspective, if I'm working with a project, you want the most broad popular support that you can get, to the point where it's just sort of seen as, no, we're not going to mess with this project because, like Mark was saying, you have a family that works there or lives there, or it's perceived as, like, a broad benefit to society overall.
It is extremely disappointing when you look at what's happening in Honduras right now, because it's very hard to see who actually wins in the end. Like, unless, like you say, they do want to go full communist, then the communists win. But other than that, it's a lose-lose situation. And in fact, it's so easy to spin the narrative now. Oh, look at this company suing the poor Honduran people. Whereas you and I, we all know that was what you had to do in the end. No one wanted that, but what else are you going to do? You're just going to sit there and just close down and say, yeah, this project which benefits mankind, let's just shut it down, you know? And it's so disappointing to see, because nobody wins.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, if you go to Ciudad Morazan, like, there's a bunch of families there. Like, your
65 families, yeah, I think, yeah.
And, like, your kids in the street playing around. It's very safe. It's a very pleasant environment, especially when you're comparing it to the options sort of outside of the city in Chiloma. So it's tragic to see. You know, it's like, really the real victims there are for sure the average Hondurans who were, you know, just trying to live their lives and take advantage of the best opportunities available.
On that note then, why do you think it is that hasn't got out into the public, you know, idea? Like you say, those in that instance, those 65 or however many families are literally going to lose out if they shut it down. We know that for sure. But you don't often hear that. And I know that, you know, the ZAs have been used as a political punchbag since right at the beginning. And I think even almost by accident, it's not even really necessary. But why is it, when we were talking about how do you secure your place, you know, and PR, like public outreach, all this kind of stuff is super important. Why are people missing the Ciudad Morazan side of the story? Because that's, you know, Prospera is only half the story. And they're very different models. And Morazan is very hard to criticize in a way, in the way that you could understand the criticisms, even though they're wrong, but you can understand the mindset that believes the criticisms of Prospera, but not Morazan.
Yeah, it's part of it, I think, is just, you know, the Zetas just got wrapped up all in one, and you have this perception that maybe, you know, you had Prospera being this pioneering project that maybe is maybe more focused on things like biotech and medical innovation, things like that. And so if that's the leading sort of voice in the space, then they're going to get, everything else might get sort of painted as that. I also think, you know, for what it's worth, I do think the entrepreneur behind Morzon is fantastic, but I also think that like he's to some degree or another, like maybe more humble than other folks. And like he's not out there doing a ton of promotion of what's going on. In addition to that, though, I think that it is sort of hard to promote that sort of thing, because there's always going to be a perception by a lot of folks, not everyone, but a large amount of the population will always perceive a company saying, look, we're just helping regular folks. They'll always perceive that as disingenuous, whether it is or not, right? So even though like Morzon is like really, it truly is, it's a fascinating place. It really is focused on like working class folks. It really does serve this great market niche. It could definitely expand substantially, could benefit a lot more people. But I do think that because it wasn't maybe the leading voice in this, I do think the entrepreneur, when the left-wing government took over, he saw the risk and sort of maybe backed off his investment. So it didn't grow nearly as rapidly as it could have grown. So I do think then, you know, 65 families is a lot of families, but it's not like 200 families. It's not like 1,000 families, right? And that would have been a larger sort of population to like really sort of drive home the benefit that the regular working class folks are getting out of it.
Do you think that's a good strategy when you're developing places like this? Is do it really fast, get the numbers up fast. Would that be fair to say?
Yeah, I think scale is important, right? Democratic governments want to get reelected, and the functions for reelection tend to be job creation to a certain extent. Tax revenue. And so if you're able to create a lot of jobs quickly, if you're able to deliver on kind of a revenue sharing agreement or some form of tax revenue for the government, I think that makes it much more difficult for the government to kind of take a negative position against you.
Hmm. With regards to autonomy, what is your opinion on that? Like, what, is there a sweet spot? Have you got a personal goal for autonomy, or a non-personal, just realistic goal? You know, what is it with you guys? Like,
I think it depends very much on the context, right? Like, governance systems should provide services for the people living in them. So, if you have the best governance system in the world and you're in Antarctica, nobody's going to go live there. Right. And so, for example, Ciudad Morazan and Prospera have different styles of governance. Why? Because they've got different target markets. And so we tend to take that kind of approach to thinking about governance. Right. For this early stage project we're exploring in Africa, pairing urban expansion with a zone where it's basically find rapidly urbanizing areas where you've got informal settlements. And there's somebody we work with who has done urban expansion, which is basically create the urban plan for these informal settlements. And now the conversation we're having is how can we create a zone layer on top, something that would allow for, right, like land use, zoning, business registration, lower taxes. Like, what is that kind of minimum viable zone that would work with informal settlements at price point about 1,000 per capita GDP? And that's going to be something that I think is substantially different than what Prospera has now. And so I don't think we have a hard line on like what is the right authority at the city level, other than like the right authority should be one that is A, politically feasible, and two, able to deliver governance services that can attract investment, create jobs, and create the sustainable conditions for economic development.
And what about the attracting people? Let's assume that you're building from scratch and you want to fill your city with good people. What do you think the best things to do? Obviously, tax is one that attracts a lot of people, but I suppose in if you're talking about African cities, it might not be something that's as important because you're looking at the local population, really.
Yeah, I mean, the meta-level framing, I think, for like population is there's two global population trends that are sufficient to justify a new city. One is in the global south, mostly Africa and Asia, rural to urban migration. So Africa will add 1 billion new urban residents. You're also seeing kind of the final wave of urbanization in India happening. And there, the target, the way to attract people is, right, like basically jobs, probably education, infrastructure. That's going to be the determining factor for somebody who grew up on a farm and is now looking to move to the city as a teenager or young adult to make more money, to kind of enter in the global market. And then the second migration pattern is global south to global north, right? You have a lot of people that want to be in the U.S. that want to be in Europe, but we're seeing the U.S. and Europe become increasingly conservative about their borders. And I think it is possible to create kind of offshore jurisdictions in the U.S. It might be the Caribbean, and Europe, it might be Northern Europe, that have are able to take talent from around the world, plug them into the European or American labor market, capital market, but not allow for kind of full migration, because that's not politically feasible. And for that, what you would want is, right, it would depend in part on the arrangement with the local government. Many governments are reluctant to allow for mass migration of low-skilled labor because they see it as competing with their people, but it might be easier to get high-skilled labor. And then the kind of function is going to be, right, like things like airport connectivity, housing prices, taxes, jobs, et cetera. So it's, yeah, I mean, maybe not the most specific answer to your question, but it's a kind of complex matrix in terms of who's the target population, where's the location, what is the infrastructure, right? What are the job availability? And you have all of that has to fit together. Rather than some like ideal perfect governance system that you start from, it's one of several inputs into what makes a successful city.
You just made me think, actually, a lot of focus gets put on digital nomads, in especially when you're talking about Prosper and places like that. Do you think that's an important part of this movement? And the way you describe the geopolitical landscape there, it makes you think, actually, this is a very small part of it, you know?
I think it's fairly small. I think they can be an important part of kind of seeding a community, but it's unlikely they're ever going to be a large percentage of a city. So you can look at San Francisco, for example. Less than 10% of San Francisco, people in San Francisco actually work in tech, right? The vast majority of people in San Francisco have what might be thought of as normal jobs in education or in healthcare or in non-tech industries. And right, that's the tech capital of the world. I think the other challenge with digital nomads is that it's easy come, easy go. So they're, right, like easy to attract because by definition, they travel a lot, they're looking for the new exciting thing, et cetera. But it's also hard to get them to stay, and that makes kind of planning and infrastructure quite difficult. Where if you're doing a city, I think you should have a premium on longer term residents, on people who relocate there, people who might want to build their family there, than people who are just kind of quickly in and out.
Have we actually seen any data yet on the kind of evolution of the digital nomad, as in their 20s, they're digitally nomading, and then in their 30s, they're settling down? Where are they settling down? Do we know? Like, because that's obviously quite an important factor. If they've spent a bit of time when they were younger in Honduras, there's more of a chance that they're going to settle down there, I would imagine.
Yeah, that's fair. I haven't seen hard data on it. I think it is kind of, right, you saw COVID really open the bubble in terms of birth, like digital nomads. I think it increased a lot of people doing remote work, increased the number. And so I do suspect as they get in their 30s, they're going to settle down. You're seeing a lot more, right? I mean, one semi-analogy is in Europe, right? 20 years ago, there wasn't really a pan-European identity, right? Today there is, which is in part a legacy of the European Union. And I think similarly with digital nomads, you're seeing what might be described as a decreased loyalty to their home country, an increased willingness to just say, okay, look, I'm going to kind of choose from quote unquote objective criteria in terms of taxes, in terms of jobs, in terms of lifestyle for the city I want to live. And so long term, I think, yeah, you could be right that this could be a useful input, even if it's easy come, easy go for the first few years. It does it does seed a long-term community. And I think that is something that that Charter City project should take into account.
Well, with regards to that, in Africa, broadly speaking, what's the landscape like in Africa? I hear almost zero news coming out of Africa, to be honest. You know, you really do have to make an effort to find out. But what is going on with regards to even things like digital nomads? Is this a thing, or are they coming to New York and ignoring their home country?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so I'll give a couple examples here. So one, in terms of like broadly charter cities, CCI helped provide some research that went into an update of Malawi's special economic zone law. Right. So in November of 2023, so about a year ago, Malawi updated their SEZ law to allow SEZs specifically to be used for urban centers and secondary cities. Right. So that was a big update there. So, you know, a lot of people don't know about that. But in terms of like the tech landscape broadly, if you're looking at like maybe special jurisdictions and tech more specifically, there's a great project called Etana in Nigeria in the Lekki Free Zone. That's focused on a digital free zone for Nigeria, as well as sort of looking at catering to tech workers. In part there, the entrepreneurs were looking at the landscape and saying, you know, a lot of African and Nigerian in particular tech workers end up doing tech entrepreneurship in Western Europe and North America. And in part, they do that because they don't have like the infrastructure at home they need to be able to do that. So there is like a response to some degree, a recognition of maybe higher skilled labor having a comparatively higher degree of mobility around the world to go do work. You know, I have, you know, in my travels, you do meet maybe the more adventurous sort of digital nomads wherever, right? Like you'll meet some people in some places where like, wow, like I don't know how I ended up out here, let alone you. So you do see that on your travels. I do think, you know, the digital nomad type person, is just like a traveler, right? They skew high on openness. They clearly have an ability to kind of work from wherever. But because they need like internet and stuff, that they're going to typically be in places that might have higher quality digital infrastructure to begin with, which is going to start focusing them in, you know, in certain places in North America, Europe, East Asia, and parts of Latin America. And I do think that that kind of boxes Africa out a lot, oftentimes.
That place you were talking about, Etana,
yeah,
in Nigeria, is that, do you say it was a special economic zone?
So it's a project within a special economic zone. So there's the Lekki Free Zone, which is the SEZ that it's within.
And do they have residents?
I think they're still, they have, I think, land now. I think, I don't know if they have residents yet. Their big drive has been on the digital free zone aspect.
Lekki has residents.
Lekki has residents.
Do you know anywhere in Africa or which is kind of on the route to incorporating the residential aspect as a kind of benefit to benefit from the you know, the zone's benefits, if you see what I mean? So, you know, a tax regime, for example, in a zone, but residents then achieving the same tax benefits. Do you know of any on their way to that or being created with that in mind?
I mentioned earlier, there's a company called Small Farm Cities. One of the projects they're working on right now in Malawi is called Titanium Gateway. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to augment the development of a new titanium mine outside of the capital, the long way there. Part of the serious effort there the entrepreneur is working on is he wants, I think he's calling it a global campus, where he wants housing for students who are basically doing global online learning, right? So there are, I think, you do talk to entrepreneurs, whether it's Etana or Small Farm Cities or other projects, who definitely have in their mind a desire to focus on greater internet connectivity and tying in local higher skilled labor to global markets.
Going back to Mark, what you were talking about, pop-up cities, because I went to Zuzalu, I've been to one. I found it interesting. I wouldn't necessarily say I found it inspiring, but that's a very personal opinion. What's your view on pop-up cities going forward? And the benefits and the sort of drawbacks of them?
I mean, yeah, there's, I guess, two questions, that one and then two, their relation to charter cities. I mean, it's just kind of a, like, broadly a new type of event, right? The way when Vitalik started Zuzalu, the way he kind of framed it was you can plot the human interaction on two dimensions, time and number of people, right? So if you think about long time, long number of people, large number of people, that's a nation state. If you think about long time, small number of people, that's a family. If you think about like large number of people, small time, that's a concert or maybe a sporting event, a festival. If you think about like small number of people, small amount of time, it's a dinner party. And so his question was like, what is medium number of people, medium amount of time, 200 people, 2 months? And that was kind of this pop-up city model. And I think people are going to continue to experiment with what that looks like, right? There's a lot of people, for example, in Thailand now and a handful of different experiments going on. We hosted one in Zanzibar. There's Vitalia, which I think a lot of your listeners might be aware of, in Prospera. There was Aleph, which was run by Crecimiento in Argentina. There was Edge Esmeralda in Northern California. And each of these projects serve like a slightly different purpose. I think the relation to, right, like charter cities, is one that can be explored. One of the challenges of charter cities is like, how do you get the first 10 people there? How do you get the first 100 people there? And so Vitalia is arguably the best thing that's happened to Prospera in terms of increasing attention, in terms of getting people to attend, getting people to live there, spend time there, right? Prospera is on a beautiful island, but Roatan's not like the number one travel destination. It doesn't have a huge like flow through of people. The resort is not like on the bus route of the cruise ships that come in. And so Vitalia has really managed to like greatly increase Prospera's the interest, the traffic through fare. Edge Esmeralda in Northern California, the woman who helped organize it, she's also building a town. And so it's not really a charter city. They're not looking for legal autonomy, but they're going to build a very lovely town. And California is notoriously against building anything. And she's managed, based on Edge Esmeralda, to build very strong relationships with the local community. So she's much more likely than a standard developer to get legal permission to build this new town. You have Crecimiento / LF in Argentina, where they're kind of trying to organize. And there's a lot of energy and excitement because of Milei's election of kind of, okay, how do you create legal regulatory frameworks for crypto, for longevity, for these frontier technologies? And how do you try to, let's call it, entrench some of the like regulatory wins in a way that hopefully can create a sustainable framework for Argentina's continued economic growth. And similarly, what we're trying to accomplish in Zanzibar is like, how do you attract talent from the region and beyond? How do you create a culture that's kind of curious, welcoming, open? How do you empower local Zanzibaris so they're not, there's not this kind of gap between the foreigners and the Zanzibaris? And this year, I think the event went well. Most of the folks seem to enjoy it. And so we're looking at doing it again next year.
They're kind of conferences, aren't they, really? Long-term conferences.
Yeah, that's one way to think
what,
about it.
You talk about attracting people to these places. I think the number one question for me is always, how do you keep people there, especially long-term? And, you know, the digital nomads problem is that you've already mentioned is that particular demographic doesn't like to stay a long time. What are your best strategies for creating a place that people actually want to stay in? And do you even, I mean, is that high on the list of things you're thinking about? I mean, in the case of, if you're building a normal city, it's not as important to think you're going to attract people. As long as there's opportunities for them there, they're going to stay. But in the charter city space, it's a little bit different because you're often picking a place, like you mentioned, Roatan. It's not on most people's travel destination list. So you actually have to attract them there with a reason. A bit like Dubai when it first started. No one wants to live in the desert, but now everyone wants to live in the desert, you know. So what's the strategy for keeping people long term?
I think the key is it's like kind of, I don't know, what might be described as at a high level, like city design, which includes all of these elements. It's location, it's who the target population is, job creation, right, like amenities, et cetera. And so, again, this kind of one of the starting questions should be, who does this population serve, right? If you're serving people who are moving to a new city in Africa, I don't think you really have to worry about retention because those people are going to, a number of them are going to stay there, right? You can just look at a map and say, this city is 10 million people now, it's going to be 50 million people in 40 years. If you can capture 10% of that difference, right, that's 4 million people. Like maybe it's 30 million, maybe it's like 50 million, 60 million, but like there's going to be a lot of people who live there and you know that. And if you can just get a bunch of land and create kind of better services, better infrastructure, you will capture those people. If you're, I think, looking at something kind of pushing the frontier a little bit, with a little bit more out of the way, right, then it becomes really, really hard. And there you need to think very carefully about like, what is the infrastructure? How do you sequence the infrastructure build in terms of airport, in terms of port, if they don't already exist, right? Like, how do you attract an anchor tenant, somebody who might say, look, we have a strong regulatory reason to locate here, so we're going to locate here and we're going to create 500 jobs. And that creates the initial boost, and then you can have an amenity or two, right? You're not going to attract any families until you have a school. And so it does need to be this kind of comprehensive approach to thinking all of this through. And it can be easier or harder depending on what the underlying value proposition of the project is. I don't think Morazan, for example, is having a challenge with resident retention, right? The people say, oh, I can live here and my kids can play outside and I can walk outside and talk on the phone and there's no threat to my physical security, right? Those people are going to stay. And so it depends on the project and the kind of, yeah, further it is, the more digital nomad dependent, the more challenging it is to create that value proposition that gets a really critical mass of long-term residents that can transform it into a city.
Do you have any opinions on lessons that can be learned from Prospera as an example? Because now we see the situation that Prospera's in, and I don't mean it in a negative way. I don't think this is the end of Prospera at all. But what are the lessons we can learn from the sort of timeline that they've been on?
Yeah, I kind of just bring it back to our conversation earlier. I think a lot of it needs to focus on early development of a broad base of support, and I think that to some degree, for better or for worse, there are some people who will never support a charter city type project, whatever kind it is, right? It doesn't matter if it's focused on like maybe innovative industries or if it's focused on, you know, the working class. There's some people out there who just will hate the project for whatever reason, right? I don't know if it's 5% or 10% of a population wherever, but some people will never like it, right? And some people probably like it no matter what. Like you'd have to like be very, very bad in order for them to dislike it. So if you're looking at like, you know, 70, 80% of a population who is sort of initially indifferent to the idea, I think that's the sort of group you really need to focus on developing support among, right? So that is, you know, sort of the track I would take. I think Prospera is sort of a case study to some degree or another in the sort of negative perceptions about it were baked in prior to Prospera even existing, right? So because, as Mark mentioned earlier, you had this sort of political crisis prior to the passage of the Red Law and then the Zeta Law, you had, you know, perceptions early on that were not always great, regardless of how much, you know, investment Prospera brought, regardless of how many people Ciudad Morazan has helped. There was the perception, a much larger popular perception that maybe these projects were not good than I think needed to start with that, right? So I do think a lot of the approach you need to take for making sure these projects end up being successful is it needs to be thought about from like the beginning, and the beginning is way before the legislation is passed. It's when you're sitting down and thinking of the project you want to create. Part of your thought process needs to be, how am I going to develop support? How am I going to make this as non-controversial as possible among the largest number of people possible?
Do you have a couple more questions? I won't keep you. with regards to kind of in the sort of free cities, charter cities space, I see a couple of different ends of the spectrum. One is the kind of create the network state end. Let's create an online community and then manifest it in real life. And then at the other end, it's almost like the free cities end. It's free privacy is like build a place and then let's attract the people. Which end do you guys fall on, or maybe in the middle? I don't know.
A little bit more on the build a place, I think. The most successful network state in the last 50 years was arguably Jonestown, which obviously did not turn out particularly well. And so I think we focus on working with governments, working with private sector developers to create charter cities that can attract people and hopefully increase economic growth to by a small amount that compounds and helps really alleviate poverty.
Do you think there's any merit in the network state idea? One thing I ended up talking about yesterday was the fact that if you've got 15,000 signatures, albeit you don't really know whether they mean it, but say you have, and you take those signatures to a government, do you think it gives you more leverage or not?
Definitely gives you more leverage. And like you're already seeing, like there are examples of some semi-successful network states. I mean, Israel is a network state on some margin, right? Utah, Salt Lake City are like network states on some margin, even the Free State Project, which is like not super successful, but like reasonably successful, is like a network state on some margin. So like people matter, migration matters. Kind of proof of concept when negotiating with government matters. So I don't want to dismiss the network state concept out of hand. It's just that one, I think if executed incorrectly, has a risk of things going very, very poorly. And then two, it's just not the thing that really gets me most excited.
Yeah. I think a lot of it has to do with target market, right? Like who's your target market? And that'll determine whether or not you're interested in more of a physical infrastructure led approach or a network led approach. And I think because a lot of our focus is on economic development, a lot of that leads us to sort of naturally have an infrastructure first approach, so to speak, right? Because your target market is more or less local. What are you trying to do? You're trying to carve out a space with better governance to drive economic growth. So for us, I think that leads us naturally to an infrastructure-led approach. Whereas if you are maybe more focused on digital nomad type folks, you probably are just substantially naturally more focused on network and a network-led approach.
Do you have an opinion on ideological communities, intentional communities? Good idea or not?
I think they work for some people. And I think that if you look at most people, it's kind of like it's like a normal distribution curve, like with height and stuff. Like I think some people are very much naturally predisposed to being like an intentional community type person. And I think that probably most people aren't. And I think what's great about the world and great about markets is that you can cater to that and, you know, sort of fulfill that niche.
Final question then. Seasteading, good idea or not?
It looks cool.
Do you know much about it? Have you delved a little bit deep into it?
Well, you know, coming out of at least a semi-libertarian sort of background, like I'm familiar with it, you know, certainly at the conference here, I've seen a couple of presentations. I think the game BioShock is an awesome game with a great aesthetics. My sort of feeling is the market for seasteading is probably smaller than the market for like living in Prospera, right? So I think if you look at, once again, I think it goes back to markets, who are you catering to? And the problem is a lot of libertarians are happy living in New York City and going to Sovereign House events and meeting up with their libertarian friends and, you know, some of their conservative or liberal friends and kind of complaining about the statists. And so if they're happy to do that in New York with like a 50% tax burden or something like that, I think the market for living on a seastead is probably not a huge big market. And I think if you are interested in seasteading, I think that would probably be my number one concern, is how do we capture the maximum size of this market? And is this market able to pay for the service we're trying to offer, or the infrastructure we're trying to offer?
Mark?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, my understanding is just, it's not cost competitive. Building floating platforms is very expensive, especially in the open ocean. And until you can actually have cost competitive floating platforms, seasteading is a fun idea, not much more. The best way forward, right? You do see places like Hong Kong, like Singapore, that have very high land prices that are investing in floating platforms because it does make sense, even when it costs like $1,000 per square meter or $100,000 per acre, $200,000 per acre. When you're in Singapore, that is a price point that makes sense. If I'm a billionaire who really, really wants seasteading to happen, what I would do is just invest very heavily in companies that are developing floating platforms until you can push the price point down sufficiently that it actually becomes competitive on a kind of market level where it's not just ideologues who are considering living there, but there is some kind of value proposition for the average person who says, I can live in, like, I don't know, maybe not New York, but like Raleigh or Denver, or I can live on Seastead number 5. And they'll have similar kind of lifestyles. And then I'm making a decision based on like, what's the job opportunity? What's the education opportunity? Where does my significant other want to live? And that's, if you can hit that price point and get that value creation, right? That's when seasteads actually become competitive.
It does make me think that one day those kind of things will exist. Just thinking about the market will be there. I presume, unless we have, you know,
if depends on the cost.
True, it does give another cost. All right, I've just thought of one final question. Sorry, the kind of landscape, the Free Cities landscape in 50 to 100 years. How would you like to see it yourself? What's your vision? The kind of thing that you're kind of working towards.
Yeah, so I think my perspective on this, I think markets are broadly good. I think that a market for governance hasn't really existed in the 20th century. I think that maybe it used to exist to some greater degree in Europe, right? I think that is something certainly Titus Giebel talks about a lot, the free imperial cities in the Holy Roman Empire. I think that I would like to see an emergence in more competitive governance. I think, you know, Prince Hans Adam II wrote a book, The State in the Third Millennium, where that this is his thesis of states will focus more on being service providers and trying to be good service providers. I'd like to see more of that, where you are competing more for providing the best sort of outcome for your residents. I think you will probably, what I want to see is, I want to see this, and I want to see good things happen. I think realistically, you know, the world's a complicated place. I think you will see charter cities. I think you'll see free cities. I think you'll see some of these that have more of an economic impetus. I think you'll see some that have more of a lifestyle impetus. And I think you will also see lots of traditional states of some kind or another. And you'll see the exact same sort of pressures you see in the world today, just maybe with a more diverse cast of political entities involved.
Yeah, I think part of what we see in 100 years, it doesn't just depend on like charter cities, it depends on a lot of other things. And so if I think about what the kind of, I don't know, key inputs are to basically like global governance systems or regional governance systems, some very important ones that we're facing right now. One, demographics, right? Like basically we've seen a massive, basically in the entire world except for Africa and like some parts of Middle East, Central Asia are facing massive demographic challenges. And that's going to have a huge impact on what states look like in the 21st century or in the 22nd century. We're seeing major technological innovation in a way we might arguably haven't seen in almost 100 years in terms of AI, in terms of biotech, in terms of drones. That's going to have a massive impact on state formation. We're seeing kind of a rapidly changing geopolitical order, where since the end of the Cold War, right, it was a unipolar order with the US as hegemon. And we're seeing the earlier, maybe even like early middle stage of the decline of US hegemony, which is going to see a greatly changed geopolitical order. And so there's multiple ways to think about kind of charter cities. Like one is, right, like weird institutional forms exist on the periphery of empires, right? In the empire will want some degree of institutional homogeneity because they want to be able to kind of have something they can look at and is legible and govern. When that doesn't happen, on the edge, you see a much higher degree of institutional variance, of which charter cities, free cities might be one example. I think my baseline guess is that most of the technological change that's happening is going to empower not all existing political units, but some existing political units, right? And we're going to see an increasing kind of power differential where the countries that can develop effective drone technology, the countries that can effectively integrate kind of AI administrative technology, are going to kind of jump ahead, maybe not like fully invent maxim gun level, but like somewhere within that order of magnitude in terms of the power differential with other countries. And so I see charter cities as one input into this kind of rapidly changing emerging framework, where the best case scenario, I think they can play a really meaningful role in the next 100 years in economic development in Africa, in technology transfer in Asia, Central Asia, Latin America, in kind of creating new agglomerations with different ideas, different kind of experiments that we can learn from throughout the world. But given what I expect to be a very kind of chaotic century in terms of global political institutional change, I'm wary of making very strong predictions on exactly where we end up.
Fair enough. Well, thanks for coming, both you, Carl, and Mark. Really enjoyed this conversation. Thanks for sharing your wisdom, and good luck with your projects in Africa and Zanzibar and all your other stuff. And thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks very much.